He walked barefoot through Babylon, armed only with truth, drumbeats, and dreadlocks. They called him the Quiet One, but he was never silent. He was the voice of the mystic drum. Bunny Wailer, founder, fighter, father, prophet. From trenched-down zinc fences to the hills of Zion, his journey was not just music, it was message. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean audiobook. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss a story. Today, we're honored to bring you Bunny Wailer, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Get ready to immerse yourself in a powerful narrative that goes beyond music, into legacy, resistance, and roots. Because here, our mission is simple: to keep our culture alive, one story at a time. Chapter 1, Roots of a Revolutionary. The wind whispered through the hills of Nine Mile, curling around the tall stalks of sugarcane and the thick arms of breadfruit trees like a living prayer. It was April 10, 1947, when Neville O'Reilly Livingston came into this world. Born not in a hospital, not even in a clinic, but on sacred earth under the quiet roof of a country home, in a village that slept beneath Jamaica's sun like a secret. Nine Mile was no ordinary place. It was a realm suspended between poverty and prophecy, between hardship and hope, where music wasn't just heard, it was felt in the bones, passed down like gospel in the rhythm of hammers on tin and the sway of Nyabingi chants echoing through Blue Mountain fog. Neville's mother, the strong and God-fearing Miss Tyne, held him to her chest as if she knew the world would come for him one day. His father, Thaddeus Shutt Livingston, wasn't always around. Not consistently, not the way a boy sometimes needed, but his absence would soon be filled by something far more eternal than blood. The pulsing drumbeat of roots reggae, the teachings of Rastafari, and the bond of chosen family. Even then, as a newborn, Bunny's fate was braided tightly with destiny, with sound, with revolution. Just a short walk from the Livingston home, in the same red dirt and rural terrain, another young boy played barefoot, Robert Nesta Marley. Their friendship, that of Bunny and Bob, began not in fame or fame's shadow, but in the dust of their village and the scrape of their shared hunger. Two boys, bound by rhythm and want, would grow to shake empires with their voices. But in the beginning, they were just children of the hills, ducking under mango branches, watching goats chew plastic, and listening to their elders speak in parables that sounded like riddles but carried the weight of ancestral truth. Neville was different, even then. Where Bob was fire, Bunny was water, cool, contemplative, deeply observant. He watched the world from behind serious eyes, absorbing every detail, every vibration, every injustice. He heard music not just in melodies but in silence, the pause between thoughts, the echo in valleys. His early years weren't glamorous, but they were textured. Long walks to fetch water, prayers before meals, and the endless struggle of the working class to keep faith alive amid colonial residue and spiritual drought. Jamaica was still finding herself, and so was Bunny. Church was central to life in Nine Mile. Bunny sat in pews carved by hand, listening to the cracked voices of old women sing psalms, their vibrato trembling like the leaves outside during rainy season. But it wasn't only the Bible that spoke to him. At night, under star-salted skies, elders would pass around stories like they were sacred relics, tales of Marcus Garvey, of African kings, of Zion and repatriation. These weren't just stories, they were prophecies. And Bunny, even as a boy, began to wonder if he was meant to be more than a farmer's son. When Bunny's mother moved to Kingston in search of opportunity, Bunny remained in the countryside for a time, but fate pulled him forward. The capital city of Kingston was a different beast entirely, loud, unrelenting, and brimming with contradictions. Trenchtown, where he would reunite with Bob and later meet Peter Tosh, was both crucible and curse. The zinc fences hummed with heat. Poverty, violence, and desperation dripped from every corner, but so did rhythm. So did the heartbeat of a people on the verge of awakening. Bunny saw the duality of it all. In the slums, he found pain, yes, but also poetry. In the noise, he found nuance. In the chaos, a kind of coded order. He started experimenting with harmonies in makeshift studios, banging on anything that could echo a beat. His voice, still raw, held a depth that surprised people, velvety, full of soul, with a quiet power that didn't shout but stirred you from within. The streets taught him resilience. And through those same dusty alleyways and repurposed sound systems, Bunny began to witness something miraculous. Music as movement. Music as protest. Music as resurrection. It wasn't just about melodies, it was about resistance. He saw how reggae could gather people, inspire them, shield them, embolden them. And that knowledge dug itself deep into Bunny's bones. He didn't crave the spotlight the way others did. He didn't chase stardom or seek applause. Bunny walked his own spiritual path, one defined by introspection and grounded in the teachings of Rastafari. It was this clarity, this refusal to compromise, that would later make him a guardian of roots reggae and a thorn in the side of commercial forces trying to bleach it clean. But in these early days, he was still becoming, still forming, still watching. The first spark of the Wailers hadn't ignited yet, but the flint was in his spirit. He was a boy forged in struggle, but destined for spirit fire. He didn't yet know he'd be the last one standing, or that he'd outlive not just his friends, but the very era they helped create. All he knew, as he stood barefoot in a patch of sunlight between rusted zinc sheets, was that something inside him needed to be voiced. Something ancestral, something defiant, something drenched in both sorrow and joy. And so, the roots of a revolutionary were planted. Not in fame, not in studio lights, but in the sacred soil of Nine Mile. A place where music wasn't made. It was born. Chapter 2, The Trenchdown Baptism. If Nine Mile had been the cradle of Bunny Wailer's spirit, then Trenchdown was its crucible, where innocence collided with survival, and music became more than melody. It became oxygen. The move from the peaceful hills to Kingston was not made lightly. It was a shift from silence to chaos, from space to suffocation. Trenchdown wasn't just a location, it was a state of mind. A patchwork of corrugated metal, cinder block, open drains, and communal suffering. Built as a public housing project in the 1940s, it had quickly devolved into a ghetto. It was where Jamaica buried the poor and then blamed them for surviving. Neville Livingston, still barely more than a boy, arrived in this urban maze with a spirit hardened by country life, but wholly unprepared for the war zone that greeted him. The streets of Trenchdown were alive with contradictions. The wail of babies mixed with the echo of gunshots, the laughter of children dancing barefoot beside old men cursing Babylon, the scent of ackee and saltfish wafting through air thick with tension and dust. But it was there, in the belly of struggle, that Bunny found Bob again. Bob Marley, his brother in all but blood, had also made his way to Kingston with his mother, said Ella. Their reunion wasn't dramatic. No embraces under golden light. Just a nod. A look. A recognition. In a place where everyone was trying not to drown, finding someone who had seen you before the storm felt like salvation. They were still teenagers, but something ancient stirred between them. It wasn't just friendship anymore. It was prophecy calling. Trenchdown's beating heart was Second Street. It was here that aspiring singers and hustlers crossed paths with Rastas, pimps, and prophets. It was here where Bob, Bunny, and Peter Tosh, tall, sharp-tongued, and uncompromising, would forge the early sparks of the Wailers. Before the record deals, before the world tours, there was just a borrowed guitar, endless freestyles, and the shared belief that music could be weaponized against oppression. They rehearsed in yards full of hungry dogs and barefoot toddlers. Peter brought defiance, Bob brought fire, and Bunny brought balance. His harmonies weren't just technical. They were spiritual scaffolding. He could hear the holes in a song before anyone else. He wasn't always the loudest in the room, but his silence carried weight. There were days when Bunny would sit for hours in the shadows, watching the neighborhood unfold like a slow, burning play. He watched young boys turned into gunmen by poverty's seduction. He watched girls no older than his sisters selling their youth for bread. He saw how power functioned in this place, who had it, who wanted it, and who was crushed trying to get close to it. These observations would find their way into lyrics. Not just his own, but Bob's too. Bunny wasn't just a singer. He was a mirror, a spiritual lens. And even though history would often cast him in Bob's shadow, those who truly knew the music understood that Bunny's voice, his spirit, was in the marrow of the message. It was in Trenchdown that Bunny's connection to Rastafari deepened. The words of Marcus Garvey, the proclamations of Emperor Haile Selassie, the chants of Nyabingi elders, it all began to make sense. The world wasn't broken, it was colonized. Jamaica wasn't poor, it was robbed. And black men weren't lost. They were exiled kings waiting to remember. He began growing his dreadlocks, not as fashion, but as defiance. In a time when locks could get you beaten, denied work, or jailed, this was Bunny's first real act of rebellion. It wasn't loud. It didn't need to be. It was a declaration written in hair and faith. Music, for the Wailers, became the only escape, the only therapy. They played for scraps. They practiced in sweat. Their harmonies weren't polished, they were raw, hungry, revolutionary. And Bunny. Bunny became the voice of the underground spirit. While Bob wrote for the people, Bunny wrote for the soul. His spirituality grew deeper with every injustice he witnessed. The corrupt politicians handing out weapons to boys who barely had shoes. The police who raided houses not to find criminals, but to assert power. The way Babylon chewed up dreams and spat them into the gutters. Bunny watched it all, and he wrote. Wrote verses soaked in sorrow, redemption fire. And as he began to understand his role in this rising force, he became more focused, more deliberate. Fame was never his goal. Liberation was. The early days with the Wailers weren't easy. There was constant friction. Money was tight. Food was tighter. They borrowed instruments, walked miles to reach rehearsal spaces, and were often chased off by those who didn't understand or didn't want to. Studio One, run by Clement Coxone Dodd, would be their first real break. But even before those studio lights flickered on, Bunny had already made his vow. He would not compromise. He would not dilute the message to fit radio. He would not trade roots for riches. In those tight Kingston nights, when the air was too hot to sleep and the dogs barked like warnings, Bunny would stare at the zinc ceiling and dream, not of stardom, but of Zion, of redemption songs sung from mountaintops, of Africa, of a black nation rising, unchained and unbroken. He was baptized in trenchdown, not in water, but in fire, in revolution, in rhythm. Every blow he took in those days became a note in his voice. Every silence he endured became a verse in his story. He wasn't just preparing to sing. He was preparing to lead. Chapter 3. Birth of the Wailers. It didn't happen with fireworks. There was no dramatic spotlight, no fanfare, no sweeping orchestral score in the background. The birth of the Wailers began in rooms without ceilings, under streetlights that buzzed like angry bees, and in the margins of a Jamaica that never imagined three poor black youths would one day shift the cultural axis of the world. The idea was born out of necessity. Music wasn't a dream, it was a lifeline. In Trenchtown, when you had no money, no influence, and no protection from Babylon's wrath, all you had was your voice. And even that could be silenced with a single bullet. So they sang not just to be heard, but to survive. Bunny Wailer, Bob Marley, and Peter Tosh didn't start as the Wailers. They started as teenagers with fractured pasts and uncertain futures. They met through community, through rhythm, through pain. And as fate would have it, they collided like charged atoms, not knowing the energy they would unleash. They were different in many ways. Bob was kinetic, filled with fire and passion, always talking, always moving. Peter was sharp-edged, militant, with a tongue that could slice through hypocrisy in seconds. And Bunny. Bunny was the quiet force, the foundation. He didn't need to dominate a room. He was the room's gravity. Their earliest rehearsals were chaotic affairs, noisy, makeshift sessions with borrowed guitars and borrowed time. They rehearsed wherever they could, in alleyways, on street corners, in the back of yards where zinc fences kept out stray dogs but not the sound of Babylon's boots. They harmonized not in perfect pitch, but in raw emotion. The notes bent and broke with the weight of their lives, their hunger, their loss. And somehow, that made it all more real. Joe Higgs, the godfather of reggae, became their first true teacher. A gifted singer and songwriter, Higgs took them in when no one else would. He drilled them on harmony, breath control, rhythm. He taught them how to hold a note like it was a weapon. But more than anything, he taught them how to channel their reality into their sound. Higgs didn't soften them. He refined them. And Bunny, with his natural ear for detail and a voice that carried both velvet and iron, became the glue in their growing sound. When Bob strayed from key or Peter charged ahead, Bunny brought them back into alignment. Not with force, but with finesse. It was Bunny who insisted that harmony wasn't just about singing together, it was about breathing together, feeling together. And it was this philosophy that gave their early music a kind of spiritual weight that listeners couldn't explain, only feel. By 1963, they called themselves the Wailers. The name was a message. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't commercial. It was a cry, a howl from the belly of the oppressed. We are the Wailers meant. We are those who cry out against injustice, against hunger, against colonial lies. It was defiance disguised as melody. Their first real opportunity came at Studio One under the guidance of Clement Coxone Dodd, one of the most powerful producers in the emerging Jamaican music scene. Coxone Studio, located on Brentford Road, was the birthplace of ska and rocksteady. But more than that, it was a proving ground. To record there meant you had something real, something dangerous. Walking into Studio One for the first time, Bunny could feel the ghosts of the greats in the walls, voices that had come before, rhythms that never left. But he wasn't intimidated. If anything, he was calm, focused. This wasn't just music. This was prophecy taking shape. Their first major hit, Simmer Down, exploded across Jamaica like a thunderclap. The message was clear: stop the violence, cool the rage, but it was delivered with such energy, such youthful urgency, that it felt like a call to arms. The country was on fire, and these young men were singing not from the outside, but from the inferno's heart. And yet, even as the spotlight began to lean in, Bunny remained anchored. He didn't chase the light. He guarded the foundation. He sang, yes, but he also strategized. He handled business. He questioned contracts. He resisted being used. He made it clear that the Wailers would not just be performers. They would be leaders, thinkers, revolutionaries. He had no interest in being anybody's puppet. As the group's fame grew, so did the tension. Bunny saw how the industry tried to fracture unity, how it elevated Bob as the face, while minimizing Peter's militancy and Bunny's mysticism. He saw how foreign labels and managers whispered poison into ears, pushing division through ego and promises of solo glory. Still, he stayed. Because at that time, the mission was bigger than the cracks. The Wailers weren't just becoming famous, they were becoming dangerous. Their lyrics cut through propaganda. Their style, dreadlocks, Rasta chants, and Pan-African imagery, was terrifying to the Jamaican elite and alluring to the poor. They were everything Babylon feared: articulate, rebellious, and unbreakable. Their chemistry was lightning in a bottle. Bob, the evangelist. Peter, the warrior. Bunny, the priest. Each played their role, not perfectly, but powerfully. And when their voices came together on songs like Put It On or Duppy Conqueror, something otherworldly happened. It wasn't entertainment. It was elevation, ritual, soul fire. But fame, like fire, consumes. And Bunny was already feeling the heat. He saw how the crowds grew, how the industry twisted them into a brand. He watched as the message began to bend, subtly, slowly. He questioned everything, every deal, every tour, every attempt to dilute their roots in exchange for a wider market. And so even in these early days, the seeds of divergence were already sprouting. Still, Bunny never wavered in those first years. He wrote, he harmonized, he grounded. He taught Bob about spiritual balance, Peter about restraint, producers about fairness. And every night, when the stage lights faded and the fans went home, he sat alone in silence, praying not for fame, but for freedom. This was the beginning, the sacred birth. Before the world knew their names, before Marley was mythologized, before Bunny became the last man standing, there were three boys, three rebels, three messengers. And from their mouths came a cry the world could no longer ignore. The Wailers had arrived. Chapter 4, A Voice with a Message. Long before he stood on stages as a legend, long before headlines called him a reggae icon, Bunny Wailer was a vessel, a conduit for something far older and far deeper than fame. While others sang to be seen, Bunny sang to speak truth, to echo the pain of a people left in the margins of history. His voice wasn't just melodic, it was medicinal. It didn't seek applause, it sought awakening. After the Wailers' initial wave of success with tracks like Simmer Down, Put It On, and Mellow Mood, the group began to define not just a sound, but a philosophy. And at the heart of that philosophy was Bunny. Though often seen as the quiet one, his contributions were neither passive nor secondary. Bunny was the guardian of message, the one who reminded everyone, whether in studio or on stage, that reggae wasn't for entertainment. It was for emancipation. He was deliberate. Every lyric he wrote, every note he harmonized carried weight. His approach to songwriting was almost spiritual. He didn't write from impulse, he wrote from meditation, from observation, from communion with the ancestors. He would often sit for hours in silence, burning a spliff rolled tight like scripture, waiting for the rhythm of his thoughts to sync with the heartbeat of the earth. And when they did, when that moment came, it was as if the words fell from the sky and landed fully formed in his lap. Dreamland was one such song. It wasn't flashy. It didn't explode on the charts. But it burned slow, steady, eternal. In it, Bunny sang not just about a mythical paradise, but about Africa, the homeland stripped from the Caribbean soul through centuries of slavery and separation. His voice on that track is haunting, measured and mournful, but unwavering. He sings like a man who's seen Zion in his dreams, but knows the path to get there is long and lined with suffering. That was Bunny's gift. He didn't just make music, you felt his music in your bones. As Bob began to rise as the charismatic frontman, industry insiders and producers leaned heavily on the Marley brand. They saw dollar signs in his charisma, and Bunny saw what it meant. Slowly, methodically, the machinery began reshaping the Wailers into Bob's vehicle. Bunny didn't hate Bob for it, but he hated the way Babylon operated. He hated how they tried to turn revolution into product, message into market. So he resisted, quietly, constantly. He refused to dilute lyrics, refused to cut his locks to be more palatable to foreign markets, refused to smile for the cameras if there was nothing to smile about. And in doing so, he preserved something rare and powerful, authenticity. The group, by then, had begun recording more deeply spiritual political material. Songs like Get Up, Stand Up, Rebel Music, and Burnin' and Lootin'. And while Peter Tosh was the militant spark and Bob the poetic fire, it was Bunny who grounded everything in roots. In righteousness. In reverence. He never forgot what reggae was birthed from, oppression. It wasn't born in nightclubs. It was born in the struggle. In the heartbeat of the Nyabingi drums. In the whispers of Garveyites and dreadlocked mystics who had been dismissed as madmen. Bunny saw them not as lunatics, but as prophets. And he felt duty-bound to echo their truths. During this period, Bunny also became more entrenched in his Rastafari beliefs. He fasted. He studied scripture. Not just the Bible, but the writings of Garvey, the speeches of Selassie, the teachings of the elders. He became increasingly vocal about the spiritual and political dimensions of Black liberation. For Bunny, reggae and Rasta weren't accessories. They were sacred tools. One for healing, the other for awakening. In interviews, he would often speak slowly, deliberately, never wasting words. When asked about the music industry, he would respond not with anger, but clarity. Reggae is not for jump and whine. Reggae is for stand firm and see clear. Babylon Tech we music and turn it into circus. But the roots remain. Always. This mindset often put him at odds with producers and promoters who wanted radio-friendly singles and flashy tours. Bunny wasn't interested in showmanship. He was interested in message. When the group traveled to England, Bunny's discomfort deepened. The cold weather, the foreign tongues, the strange stares. But more than that, it was the distance from home, from Jamaica's soil, from the rhythm of his ancestors. He hated the commodification of their culture. Hated singing for audiences who didn't understand the weight of the lyrics. He wasn't there to be exoticized. While Bob and Peter adapted, Bunny pulled back. He missed performances. He refused to travel internationally for long periods. And many misread that as laziness or ego. But those close to him knew better. Bunny wasn't afraid of success. He was afraid of losing the mission. He didn't want to become a reggae star. He wanted to remain a reggae servant. And in those quiet battles, something incredible happened. Bunny began writing solo material. He poured himself into lyrics that dripped with spirituality, resistance, and grace. Songs that weren't designed for fame, but for frequency. His voice deepened, matured. It carried the ache of exile, the wisdom of elders, and the fire of a man who had watched Babylon try to tame revolution and refused to let them. In private moments, he would strum his guitar under the moonlight, singing to the wind, to Jah, to the memory of ancestors. Sometimes he wouldn't even record the songs, just let them live in that space, for that moment. For Bunny, music didn't always need to be documented. It just needed to be true. As the Wailers climbed higher, Bunny's disillusionment grew. But not his faith. His belief in the power of message, of music as ministry, remained unshaken. And that belief, that unwavering spiritual core, became his compass. It led him not to the heights of fame Bob would one day reach, but to the depths of truth that so few dared to explore. By the time the group released Catch a Fire and Burnin', Bunny was already emotionally halfway out the door. But while his body stood in the shadows, his voice, his harmonies, his lyrics, his unwavering commitment to spiritual clarity, remained front and center. He was the soul in the sound, the whisper behind the roar. And while others sought stages and stadiums, Bunny kept returning to the root, to the drum, to the word, to the message.